You are back with The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. This is Catherine Cruz. It will be the start of a legislative session like no other. No fanfare, no entertainment or big parties. The Capitol is still shut down to the public due to COVID, and barriers surround the rotunda because of the security threat following the siege in our nation's capital on January 6th. The powerful legislative money committees wound up their budget briefings last week, and his session is about to begin tomorrow. We talked to the Senate Ways and Means Chairman Donovan Dela Cruz about the difficult decisions ahead.
Know that we have less general funds. Not all the federal funds are guaranteed to come in based on what still needs to pass Congress, except the package that just got recently passed. But this is our opportunity to look at where we can restructure parts of government to make it more efficient or effective in getting the services that the public needs.
House Finance Chair Sylvia Luke was talking about, you know, rethinking our relationship with the counties.
Yeah, I think there's several services that the state takes on that typically counties take on, such as emergency services. That's something that the state has been subsidizing. The state pays for schools. The counties don't in Hawaii, but in other places that is the case. I'm not saying that they would take that on, but we would probably, now is a good time to look at the kind of services that the state's providing and subsidizing versus what the counties typically provide.
Normally the mayors come begging for their share of the hotel room tax.
You know, the reality is when it comes to property tax, the counties do have a resort category. You know, so they do make money from the fact that they can charge property taxes to resorts and other travel-related activities.
What else are you looking at when it comes to the state budget? There was a concern initially about the furloughs and layoffs.
You know, one of the things that we've been trying to work with the governor and ask him about, and I know the House has also asked, we're looking at the retirement numbers. How many people are going to be retiring in the next year or 2 years and see what cost savings is from that.
There is the concern that we've had about the Honolulu Police Department padding their high three, you know, with the overtime. How are you folks looking at that? Because at some point, we've got all these unfunded liabilities that just keep going up, up, up.
We don't want anyone taking advantage of these different benefits because ultimately the taxpayer has to pay. So there are a bunch of proposals that are circulating currently at the ledge. We're still building consensus. We're talking to ERS and UTF to see what would be the best way to approach it so that it's fair and reasonable and transparent.
How are you looking at the governor's ideas to possibly raise taxes?
That's difficult. I think for many of us, this may not be the best time to raise taxes because so many people are taking so many different hits. You know, one of the things that we should be looking at a lot more aggressively is job creation and diversifying the economy. It may not happen overnight, but that will definitely, as time goes on, increase the tax base.
On that point, you know, you've been a big advocate of ag. You know, we hear lots of talk about we need to do better when it comes to sustainability. I mean, if anything, we've learned that with COVID because we don't produce enough food here to feed ourselves.
Exactly. So one of the things that we learned from Australia is that export has to be right there along sustainability just because value-added products and value-added crops create the revenue you need to pay for infrastructure, to pay for all the different aspects related to sustainability.
We talked about diversification for a very long time, but what else are we doing to support ag?
Well, we need a lot more support from the administration as well as the department. But, you know, traditionally the legislature has put in the last several years money to acquire ag land, money to put in for ag infrastructure. One of the things that we've been asking more about is a pathway for more agricultural jobs in regards to not just the high school level, but community college, so that people can get real training and then we can get more people in agriculture. And agriculture has evolved so much. You know, it's not the same agriculture that our grandparents had to experience where they were in the hot sun for 10 hours a day picking pineapple or cutting sugar. You know, agriculture has become high tech in many aspects. But product development is also important. You know, it's the candies, the cookies, the lotions, all the products that you can make from ag that will help create more of a demand for ag as well.
Do you think the administration is doing enough to set a pathway for us?
That's where I think the legislature can hopefully step up to the plate and work with the university system, work with the Department of Education, and work with the landowners who ultimately will become those that will work with those who come through the pathway so that they can become farmers.
You've been a big proponent of trying to do something with the state lands along the rail route. You know, how are you looking at that situation right now?
At our first budget hearing, we met with Eugene Tiang from Department of Business Economic Development and Carl Bonham, who gave us an economic outlook. And what they've recommended was putting more in infrastructure. You know we need affordable housing. We have state lands along the rail line. It's going to be housing that's not going to be single family home. It'll probably be a lot more dense. But we need infrastructure. You know, you need to put in all the underground infrastructure before anybody can build. And that will help also make the housing more affordable by the state putting in that kind of investment.
Economist Carl Bonham had talked about selling land if we need cash. Well, what do you think of that idea?
No, I'm not a big proponent of selling state land. I don't think that's a good idea. I think quite the opposite. I think the state should be acquiring more land so that we can provide different types of opportunities in regards to affordable housing or education or even agriculture. I mean, we should be a lot more strategic in land acquisition. I think it's better for the state, ultimately the taxpayer and the community to own it than I do someone coming in from out of state or out of country. You know, in our meetings with the different departments these past 2 weeks, there are going to be some opportunities for restructuring, for refocusing. This allowed us the time to look at services that maybe people don't use anymore, that they don't make a big impact. But when, in our last meeting with the Department of Education, I think they have about $270 million shortfall, but they're going to get about $183 million from the feds. And there could be more money coming from the feds with the new Biden administration coming in. Some of it is wait and see, but I think it's better for us to be conservative at the beginning until we can see what the feds are going to do and just make the structural changes we need and the right investments that we have to make so that we can expand our economy and provide people the social net service, safety net services that they still need to prevent any worse circumstances from occurring.
We're probably going to hear more about the gambling initiatives. What are your thoughts about that? Where do you think the Senate lies on that issue?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think in the past, the Senate has always introduced different gaming bills. You know, I've been a big proponent of paramutual or horse racing. We've had it historically. You know, the Kapi'olani Park was a racing track. We'll see what happens. I think it's also important to look at that it may be just enabling legislation for the Department of Hawaiian Homelands to decide what they want to do. But, you know, we're at the beginning of discussion. We'll see where it goes. I just don't want it to detract from the conversation of having to diversify our economy and create revenues from public-private partnerships or other things that we have long talked about but have not done. There's still Aloha Stadium. You know, there's lots of effort going into making sure that can get passed so we can amend a law that we passed previously. I think that's going to be a huge economic driver. I think it's needed. The stadium is falling apart, but there's also the 98 acres that we can come up with commercial and residential development right along the rail line. So I think that's going to be exciting. The other thing that I think that's important for us to look at is tourism cannot be the same way. You know, I think a lot of people have said that they don't want the same carbon footprint that tourism was before COVID. We want a higher spending visitor with lower numbers of visitors, which I think is ultimately the better strategy. But we have to put more emphasis on tech, on healthcare, on cybersecurity, and in ag.
Okay. And then whatever happened to that proposal that you had for cybersecurity, that training center out there? Is it Mililani?
Yeah, so that's moving along, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, with the governor has released funds so that we could start to plan and do the grading for the 150 acres in Mililani Tech Park. That would be the home for the state's first responders and cybersecurity tech park. You know, this whole pandemic has only proven that we need better infrastructure, better facilities, better equipment, better technology, and we need an area where the synergies of all our first responders can be more supportive for each other and ultimately have a better response for the public, a much faster response for the public good.
So is there something in his budget this year?
I don't think so, but all the years in the past, it's mm-hmm. been legislatively driven, so that may have to be the case again.
Anything else?
Council of Revenues, you know, they did provide us a little bump, and they'll be back in March, and we'll see what they say then. I think they're also looking to see what the feds come up with in the next couple months before they probably become too optimistic, but, right. You know, we're hopeful.
And then real quick, then the opening of the ledge, right? Very pared down all about business, straight to work.
Yeah, this is going to be extremely scaled back, not just because of the incidences that have occurred around the country and the capital, but just because of the whole COVID pandemic. You know, I think it's better that we really focus on social distancing and making sure people can telework so that we can prevent any type of spread. And it's really going to be focusing on the business of the people's needs.
That was Senator Donna Medela Cruz talking to us about our economic recovery and the challenges ahead for our state. Honolulu Civil Beats government reporter Kevin Dayton joins us for our reality check. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. So you're down there at the Capitol, in the belly of the Capitol building.
we are down at the chamber level. We've got an office down here now, which has been very helpful to us as we do the work down here.
Yeah, and you've got two stories running today, one on our battered state budget and then another one on the millions of dollars that we have to pay back to the federal government for unemployment claims. So kind of lay this out for us. What's the scenario?
Sure. It's just one of those years where there's lots of problems, lots of trouble to go around, basically. The budget one maybe is the best place to start. I think most people over and over has already heard that, you know, this session is going to be all about the budget. And we heard Senator talking about that just now. There was a bit of good news recently when the State Council on Revenues adjusted its projections upward. So they're guessing the focus right now is on the budget that starts for the 2 years that begin July 1st of 2021. That's what they call the biennium budget. The council is now projecting that maybe the tax collections will increase by about 6% for each of those 2 years. That's a big help. I mean, I know that Senator mentioned it's a bit of a bump, but the council's adjustment, you know, added about $300 million to the current budget and another maybe $650 million to what's expected in terms of tax collections for the next 2 years. So that's a start. That helps, although the shortfall is obviously larger than that. And the legislature is going to have to sort through a whole lot of sort of crisis management steps that the administration has taken and decide which ones they want to pursue, which ones maybe they want to not do. The more famous ones, of course, have been the proposal for furloughs, which have been kicked around since last April, but have not yet been implemented yet and apparently won't be until sometime after July 1st. Another one, the governor just submitted a budget that involves layoffs of something on the order of about 150 people. We expect the governor to send down a bunch of revisions to his proposed budget. We'll have to see whether layoffs continue to be part of the package. But clearly, there'll be some really tight restrictions on hiring and abolishing a significant number of vacancies to try to save money on those salaries. So those are the kinds of steps that we're going to be looking at. And the legislature is going to have to be going through the budget with a fine-tooth comb to try to sort all that out. And in the wings, of course, is the big variable, which will be how much can President-elect Joe Biden come through with his proposed package. He has proposed, I believe it's on the order of about $350 billion to help bail out state and municipal governments. If the state was to get a good chunk of that money, I've heard the number bandied about of maybe $1.25 billion. That would be a huge help. That would make a major, major difference in the fiscal situation for the state right now.
Right, but at the same time, I know Senator Dela Cruz said, you know, we expect some additional help, but you got to be conservative with some of your decisions just in case the money doesn't come.
Absolutely. Although I will say that, you know, Senator Brian Schatz has suggested that when it comes to the most damaging and harmful cuts, the state should hold off as long as it can to watch and see what the federal government is, in fact, able to do. So the suggestion is that he's not making promises, but the suggestion is with the Senate now in Democratic hands, and, of course, a Democrat in the White House, that there's a very good chance that the significant help will come. That doesn't mean you can put all your eggs in that basket, but there should be some help on the way.
And we did get a whole bunch of money to help with the unemployment claims, the record numbers that we saw, but we got to pay some of that money back.
Well, when the state ran out of unemployment money in the unemployment pool, which was, we started the pandemic at about $600 million in the unemployment trust fund. And when that money was drained off in payment of benefits, the state went to the federal government and borrowed about $707 million. The problem, of course, that's confronting the state right now is it's the employers of the state that are on the hook for that money. That's the state borrowed the money, but it was to pay unemployment benefits, and that money is traditionally paid back by a levy on employers. And the state legislators here have been saying, hey, you know, these businesses are already on the ropes. You can't expect them to pay back a sum that large. And technically, the money is due in November of 2022.
Right.
So that's a very heavy burden to put on employers.
Right. So, lawmakers will have to make a tough decision there. But thanks so much, Kevin.
Okay, thank you.
All right, that was reporter Kevin Dayton with today's Reality Check. Read his stories online at civilbeat.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. On this week's Stargazer, HPR's Dave Lawrence and astronomer Christopher Phillips talk about the oldest known planet.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the Information Technology and Communication Primary Facility at McMurdo Station, Antarctica. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, ferrarochoi.com.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe surrounding our tiny and troubled planet. As usual, we are fortunate to be guided through the experience with astronomer Christopher Phillips. We've got him on the line right now. Hey, Chris, welcome back. What is in store this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be back. So this week's Stargazers, Jupiter and Saturn will be low in the west during sunset, but Mars will be fully visible throughout the night till it sets at around midnight. The moon this week is passing through its first quarter phase, and so stargazing will still be wonderful through week's end.
And you have news this week, apparently, on the oldest known planet?
Yes, a distant planet discovered around an orange dwarf star located 280 light years from Earth has surprised astronomers by potentially being one of the oldest discovered planets in the universe. In fact, it is so old at an estimated age of 10 billion years that it is almost as old as the universe itself, which, by the way, is at the prime old age of 13.8 billion years. The planet was discovered by the Transiting Exoplanet Survey spacecraft, or TESS, and it has the catchy name of TOI-516b.
And what kind of world is this?
Well, the planet is thought to be small and rocky like the Earth, and it orbits very close inwards towards its star. In fact, it is so close that one day on this planet is only 10.5 hours long. The proximity to the host star almost certainly guarantees that this planet is not habitable to life as we know it.
Unless that life is meant to live in a very, very hot environment, huh?
Yeah, in board shorts weather.
And that would also be too hot for liquid water, I'm guessing?
Indeed. The surface temperature could be as high as 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's incredibly hot. Now, also, we have to remember that planets like this that are close into their stars are what we call tidally locked. That means that one side of the planet always faces the star and the other side faces out into space. So it's possible, although unlikely, that there is a region on this planet where the temperature is just right for the existence of liquid water.
The moon does a similar sort of lack of movement, right?
It does. In fact, one face of the moon, as we know, it's always facing the Earth. And the other side, what we normally call the dark side of the moon, faces out into space.
And what's the time frame on learning more about this exciting new discovery that you're talking about?
Well, I'm pretty sure that this will not be the only planet of its kind to be discovered in the TESS survey data. And these are probably going to be targets for the James Webb Space Telescope when it launches later on this year. So hopefully we won't have to wait long before we hear more about these strange new worlds.
And I know who we'll be turning to hear more about them. That'll be you. It's Christopher Phillips and another great Stargazer. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, a nonprofit devoted to conserving the unique flora and fauna of Hawaii Island. More about how to volunteer at friendsofhakalauforest.org. Support for HPR comes from Compassion and Choices, celebrating the second anniversary of the Our Care, Our Choice Act, allowing terminally ill adults to request a prescription for medical aid in dying. CompassionandChoices.org/Hawaii.
. 2020 was a year that would start with a shock to the system. A gunman would kill two police officers responding to a 911 call of a stabbing on a Sunday morning in a Waikiki neighborhood. The suspect, Jerry Hennell, also known as Yarda, attacked two women and then set fire to his unit. By chance, I happened to be at Kapili Park there that morning and talked to Warren Daniel, who happened to live next door to the assailant.
I live next door to the suspect, Jerry Hennell. I have several restraining orders against him. Prosecutor's office and the police are very familiar with him. They've been out to our house maybe 30, 40 times in the last 4 years. I woke up this morning to screaming, and the neighbor was bleeding out on her front lawn, and two policemen are down. I don't know whether they're dead or alive, but they don't look alive because they dragged them off.
Does he have firearms?
Yes. He's shot two people and attacked one with a garden tool, stabbed her in an
artery. Today? Just this morning?
Yes, this morning.
Daniel has since filed a first lawsuit against the estate of the landlady, Lois Kane. Her property is said to be in escrow right now. Daniel has since sold his. At mid-morning that day, at the height of the events, I recorded this.
Gunfire.
The fire raged, but firefighters were powerless to do much about it. As the police chief made the call, it was too dangerous for anyone else to go in. She called for strengthening our firearm and mental health laws. We talked to Senator Carl Rhodes, head of the judiciary, about the laws on the books.
The bill I think that actually would probably be the most useful in the long run is one that we had already passed before it happened, but it had only gone into effect less than 3 weeks before the incident, and that's the Extreme Risk Protection Order bill. And what that allows is for someone who is like a roommate or a colleague at work or a teacher or a law enforcement officer, and they have reason to believe that someone is having a mental meltdown of some kind, that they can petition a court to have their guns temporarily taken away. And I think that if someone in that household had that available to them months before, they might have used it and it might have saved several people's lives.
And I guess not enough people knew that it had just become law then.
Probably not. I mean, it was literally, you know, it went into effect on January 1st of 2020. And we passed usually several hundred bills a session. And, you know, there's no way to make everybody automatically aware of all of them. The other bill that didn't pass that I think would have been useful, although it's hard to tell because I don't know if they ever did determine where the guns came from, but there was some speculation that they came from someone who had passed away earlier and they just never been, you know, they'd never been properly registered with anybody new. And that was a bill to say that before an estate could close, you had to account for all the weapons, all the firearms in the estate. And that bill did not pass last year, but I think that might have been useful as well. One that did pass it, you know, depending on the exact circumstances, and I'm not I haven't seen what the exact circumstances was. I mean, I asked about it months ago, but I never heard. But it was one that we did pass that said if you're moving out of state, then you have to notify the police departments where you registered your guns that you're moving those guns out of state.
Now, if I recall, you had also introduced some other measures, I think, to limit ammunition sales. There was the one about assembling a gun from different parts.
We did pass a ghost gun bill, but I don't know if that really would have come into play with the hibiscus case. But yes, we did pass that. The ammunition bill did not pass. That was one that essentially said if you don't have a gun that the ammunition, you can use the ammunition in, you can't buy it. You have to show proof that you have a registered, you have to have a legal gun. The ammunition bill would essentially, what it would have done was say that you have to be the legal owner of a gun in which the ammunition can be used before you can purchase it. And if that had been in effect for a few years before this happened, it might have prevented it, but ammunition has a very long shelf life, so it's hard to know whether there might have been enough left over from whomever he got the gun from in the first place. But if we'd had that rule in effect 5 or 10 years ago, that probably would have helped too, because since it wasn't registered in his name, he wouldn't have been able to purchase ammo for it.
You know, and I know that Police Chief Susan Ballard was concerned about the gun laws following that shooting, but also the access to mental health, you know, for the people who desperately need it.
I mean, that's what the Extreme Risk Protection Order law is all about, is people who, especially people who were perfectly, who passed all the background checks to start with, but then had a breakdown of some kind later. But I'm not sure, I mean, how to phrase this. Yes, we should have better mental health capabilities, and I see it more frequently in Chinatown where I live, but most of the mentally ill don't commit crimes. So it's we're really looking for a needle in a haystack when it comes to the mentally ill who use weapons inappropriately. Having said that, when they do, the results are spectacular, or can be, I mean, spectacularly bad, like this instance or others where mentally ill have shot a bunch of people. So that's what the Extreme Risk Protection Order was all about, was at least have the chance for someone to intervene if they could see someone was going down a dark road.
Anything else that you know of that is going to be reintroduced this session that might address some of these issues, either with gun laws or mental health services?
Well, I'm going to put the ammunition bill back in. I mean, the mental health issue, the focus is largely on the mentally ill homeless who are a danger to themselves or others, and there will be additional legislation on that, but it's not specifically aimed at guns. Having said that, one of the beneficial side effects of it should be that there won't be as many untreated mentally ill people around, and therefore you won't have as many of these fortunately rare incidents, but you'll have even fewer of them.
I've been talking to some of the police officers, and I know they're kicking around the idea of doing a march from the substation down the street to Hibiscus Drive on that day. I just don't know if there's anything else that might be planned just to honor the officers who lost their lives in that case.
They certainly deserve all the accolades that they get. They were simply doing their duties and weren't expecting to get shot at as they came up to the guy's house. And it's very sad and a very unfortunate circumstance that fortunately doesn't happen very often.
Yeah. You know, hopefully you folks are looking at what other things we can do to rectify the situation and make sure it doesn't happen again.
There is an important point there, and that is that we did pass an Extreme Risk Protection Order bill, and everybody needs to know that, so that if they know somebody or work with somebody who looks like they're having a mental, psychological, or psychiatric breakdown, there is something you can do, and the law is already in place. So I think that's a very important point. We have a legal mechanism in place for people to intervene when they see something like that happening.
That was Senator Carl Rhodes. Russell Freeman and his wife Ellen owned a historic home on Hibiscus Drive. The sign still hangs out front on the gate, though the 1920s-era Craftsman bungalow burned to the ground. Ellen's family lived on the street for more than 60 years, and she attended La Pietra School for Girls just up the street. The Freemans are currently riding out the pandemic in New Zealand. The city just issued their building permit last week, and the family hopes to begin construction this month. Russell Freeman and his wife were having coffee when they heard their neighbor, Gisela King, cry for help as she was being stabbed with a garden tool by Yarda, who was in the process of being evicted by his landlady. The Freemans were able to get Gisela to safety, but as police responded, Russell witnessed Officer Tiffany Enriquez getting shot. Officer Kaliki Kalama would follow. Freeman said he and his wife then watched their house burn down.
Well, I sat there and watched the house catch fire. But actually, given what else had happened, you know, I saw the policewoman getting shot, sort of flying through the air. I was at the top of the drive at that time, so I guess that was more harrowing. We were just kind of glad he was dead, to be honest with you. When I met my wife later, we got separated, and the first thing she said is not, it was nothing to do with the house. He just said, "Is he dead?" I said, "Yeah, he's dead." So that was the most important thing for us, actually. Because it had been a nightmare. It was just the end of a nightmare, really.
And how has it been this year for your family?
We're all right. Truth is, we were shocked, but, you know, we got over it. I think in a month I was sort of, we just got over it and moved on, you know. We only came back a few days before the incident. We'd been in New Zealand just the summer, and we were going to go back in February. We'd only come back to Hawaii for a brief time, but with circumstances, we got stuck there.
So you generally
November,
You generally split time between New Zealand and Hawaii?
Yeah, that would be right.
Okay, all right. And so after the fire burned the home, did you go back to New Zealand right away?
Well, no. Obviously, we had to sort out everything that was happening. We had to sort out the house. So obviously our plans changed, and then of course we got stuck with COVID. But we started plans to rebuild quite quickly. I think we started around March. But it's taken us until now. We just got the permit about 2 days ago to rebuild.
And so what's the plan? Because I understand, you know, it is a historic home, and it was your wife's family home for many years.
There was no remaining historic house. According to the rules, partly damaged, you could rebuild it and still have a historic home. We're rebuilding something entirely new because we can't build it the same because there's lots of new regulations. And we're going to start fairly soon. The whole thing was called a tragedy. I think the first of all, the biggest tragedy was actually that it needn't have happened, you know, because this guy had thrown out, been throwing out these crazy signals for up to 10 years, certainly 5 years. And so that was the biggest thing. And that's the thing that I hope will come out of this is somehow, you know, I felt sorry for the police because the police were always coming to them and they would apologize to us as they left. Sorry, you have to put up with this, but there's nothing we can do, you know. And of course, the mayor said that he was going to help us, help everybody get, you know, restore their homes and all the rest of it. But actually, it's taken us a year of extremely hard work and constant frustration trying to get a permit. We first put a permit in I think 23rd of July, and we just got it now. It's actually been extremely difficult.
Hard to move on, even though you want to move on quickly.
Yeah, I mean, our contractor said he's never had so much difficulty in getting a permit as he has with this one. So It's just sort of one thing after the other. We would settle everything that, you know, they would come up with some things we needed to do. We would do them all, then they'll come up with a whole bunch of new ones. It just was a constant battle. But we kind of hope, well, that once the first anniversary is over, that we can move on.
I did talk to the Good Samaritan who had helped the lady that was stabbed.
He and I went down, after the lady at the top, we went down the driveway to see where the Yarda was sort of going to come bracing up with a weapon and attack us, you see. As Jen and I were carrying her up the driveway, I did expect to get attacked. So that was really the most scary part of the whole thing for me, because I had my arm full carrying somebody, and I had no defense. So I thought, you know, that whole moment, I thought I was going to be, you know, impaled on a fork or something. I didn't expect them to have a gun. So that was definitely, for me, the scariest part of the whole thing.
Did he threaten you personally?
Oh, dozens of times. We tried to take out a... Oh, yeah, it's a long, long...
Right, right.
long, long history. Yeah. You know, we had a lawnmower, we had fuel in our laundry, and we kept the fuel under lock and key for some years, thinking, well, yeah, he could easily burn the house down. I mean, that was just one thing. We knew he was crazy. So the minute we heard him, we heard the tenant yelling for help, I instantly knew. I thought, this is the day. You know, I instantly knew what, something really bad was going. So when my wife and I went outside, we went down. We had to go out the front door. We were yelling to call the police as we ran, you know, because we knew that something pretty bad was happening. Jennifer, the neighbor across the road, was quite literally, you know, two steps behind us. She'd come from somewhere else. So Gisela was there, and she was, my wife Ellen saw him. He was banging her head on the concrete.
Yikes.
And then when she saw him, he took off inside. But she'd been stabbed, so she was bleeding and obviously yelling. So my wife grabbed the weapon because he dropped it. She took the weapon, and then Jen and I grabbed her and took her to the top of the driveway, and he was inside at that time. So then we sat her down at the top of the drive next to the car, and then the police arrived, and I'm standing at the top of the driveway. The lady went past me down the driveway, and she pulled her pistol and asked them to come out, and she got shot. But by that time, things get a bit fuzzy, because I remember I saw the ambulance arrive, so I sort of thought, well, I should go and get the ambulance guys to come down. So I sort of headed off in a bit of a fog by this time, you know, pretty shocked. So I remember I went down with the idea of getting the medical people, you know, to come and pick her up, which is one solution. But, of course, that kind of never happened, because by that time there was peace. Well, there was, by that time the peace had been shot, and the other guy went down a few minutes later, and he got shot too. So.
Did you ever see Lois after that?
So nobody actually saw her, but she was in the laundry, which was in behind the door, basically.
Gosh.
So, you know, one thing we think, of course, is that, you know, Jen and I got, we bought Gisela, scared them off and bought Gisela to the top of the driveway, but we also think that actually Gisela probably saved our lives as well, because Gisela going down wasn't part of his plan, whatever his plan was. You know, Lois went down and he grabbed her and killed her, so clearly he had some other plan.
Right.
But he didn't expect Gisela to show up.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe he was going to, he had the house ready to burn. He'd been setting that up for a couple of months. We didn't know he used to cut little bits of wood and all the rest of it.
Mm.
We had no idea what he was doing, but actually he was setting the whole place up to, he had plans to burn it down.
Wow.
But, you know, if Gisela hadn't showed up, what would he have done? Well, you know, he can only speculate, but he wasn't just going to kill Lois and go back and have a cup of tea, was he? So he may well have been planning to, he wanted the house to burn down. But, you know, he could have come out with his gun and started shooting the neighbors. You don't know, but, you know, the reality is that sort of Lois was his last friend, really, you know, because he fell out with everybody because he attacked them.
Right.
So, you know, the fact that Lois sort of defended him from afar, because she wasn't actually there for 5 years. He sent 100 red flags.
Right.
That he was mentally unwell. So, you know, that's kind of what I would hope might change in the future, if I could do anything, you know.
That was Russell Freeman, whose home on Hibiscus Drive burned to the ground. Not long after the tragedy, students and faculty at La Pietra Hawaii School for Girls reached out to their neighbors. The campus opened its doors to residents and first responders who responded to the 911 calls. Senior McKenna Kinsler helped out that day. She says this year the girls wanted our first responders to know that they're still in our thoughts. The students made cards last week to thank the firemen and police officers for their service that day and every day that they are on the job.
Because of COVID and social distancing and all that, we're not able to physically go down to the area, but as a school, we made cards just to kind of reflect and kind of give some gratitude back to the community for the first responders who were there. Right after it happened, we took a pause and just decided that we wanted to do something for the community and kind of reach out, like open arms, and just do something for those who were affected, because it was such a tragic event that took us off tracks, that startled everyone. And our school, we weren't physically hit as hard, but we mentally and personally had just as much remorse. So we wanted to do something to kind of bring us together.
And what was that like? Because you were involved in putting that together.
Everyone was really looking forward to that day because it was like a positive moment and kind of like a little bit of a dark time. And I remember a bunch of people's families brought a bunch of different foods and desserts. And then I also believe Outrigger Canoe Club donated food as well to the event. So we all kind of gathered together on our great lawn, and there was a bunch of tables and people also sat on the grass, and it was really neat to see the students and the other people within our school kind of not be afraid to sit down next to the firefighters and make conversation with them and just get to know them and how they were feeling and how they were doing. So that was really nice, and it was just a really happy moment amidst the sadness, which I think was really cool to see my school do and to be a part of that.
And some of the students at La Pietra were there that morning when that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that must have been kind of scary for them.
Yeah, I know. I think it happened on a weekend, so we weren't in school, fortunately, but a lot of people live around the area or have family who live around the area. I know a couple people had, like, paddling practice at Outrigger or swimming. There was a Leahy swim class on our campus, too. So they were all very taken off guard, and I remember just hearing that they were scared or they didn't know what was going on. Yeah, we did have people at our school who were there that day.
It was a good thing that they were able to get out safely. But mm-hmm. Yeah, it was pretty dramatic, mm-hmm. You know, the events of that day. And you know, knowing that those officers died, you know, trying to protect the community there. Talk some more about the cards that you folks made.
Each hui, which is like our version of a homeroom, got like two cards that two students would write on behalf of the hui, just for the first responders, and just kind of like that we're still thinking of you and that we're still very grateful for what you did for our community, and just remembering the event and just thanking them again. I think that's something we should do as a school, just to continue this tradition, because it was such a big tragic event in our community, and I think remembering it is important. So I hope it's something that becomes an annual thing.
That was McKenna Kinsler, a senior at La Pietra, who helped organize last year's gathering to help their neighbors heal. The day was called a gathering of gratitude. Headmaster Joshua Watson said the school was glad to provide a forum for the residents and police and firefighters to connect following the events of that tragic day. He said it was the neighborly thing to do, after all. Stephanie Sofos lives around the corner from Hibiscus Drive and personally knew all the families involved. We talked to her this morning about how everybody's in different stages of healing.
Not a day goes by that I don't think about the officers and Lois and even Yarda. And I pray and I think that let's all have peace. We need to have peace. I just keep hoping that everybody can be okay. Who knows what you can do about it? You just have to get through it.
For some people, it might be a matter of forgiveness. We've just been so traumatized just watching all the images and, you know, kind of reliving that day.
Yeah, you know, Gisella, who was stabbed by Yarda, she has forgiven him, and she actually thinks of Yarda because he was her friend, and Yarda was a friend of mine for 20 years. I just feel I don't know how I feel about him. I don't know if I have quite forgiven him, but I do feel a lot of sadness. But I have asked, most of the neighbors have moved on. It's kind of hard. I don't know if I could have if I had lost everything that I owned, or if I had lost a loved one like the officers did, I don't know if I could have forgiven, but I'm hoping that we get there. They said, someone said the power of forgive to me the other day. He said the power of forgiveness is the greatest gift you can have and give. And so I'm working on that. Personally, I'm working on that.
People who are intimately involved are probably reflecting on this day. Maybe the families will get together. You know, the officers will kind of help console each other for their loss. I drove by there, by the station yesterday afternoon, and, you know, they had a table up, and, you know, people I think were starting to put flowers just to remember them and to honor them.
Yes, the neighbors have texted each other, and we're all going to get together. I don't know when, but we're all going to get together and make sure that we're all together and tell each other we love them, because we do. And that's the saddest part of all of this, the camaraderie that we used to have. We used to have block parties, and I knew all of the children who grew up, and we all went trick-or-treating together, and we went caroling together on Christmas, and we had a big party on July 4th where everybody came and made food and potlucked, and that's all gone right now. So trying to get that back has not been easy. Maybe when the houses are all rebuilt, but one person has already sold. Lois is gone. Her house is being, her property is being sold. A couple of other houses are being sold. So it's going to be a very difficult, I mean, a very changed environment, no matter what we try to do going forward.
And there are families that have opted to remain to stay. There was one family that you helped out. There were two children who were distressed at what was unfolding. But as a good neighbor, you stuck around.
I always tell the mother, Jen Tima, she said, in all of the chaos, she said, don't leave my children. And I was kind of pinned, and I said, I won't leave your children. I promise you. And knowing the strength of that woman, it did cross my mind that if I left them, that she would hurt me. So I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to leave the kids. No, in all seriousness, I made her a promise, and I wasn't going to go against that promise. And those kids, I've seen them since before they were born. They're like my own. I wasn't going to leave them.
Yeah, and they managed to get out. They got on their roof.
Yeah, what happened is Jen and Eric had taught them fire drills. And so when the fire started and it became very intense, they came out towards where I was, and I told them to get back in the house. And I said, do not come out. You stay in the house, and I'll come and get you after this. And so then they went back into the house, but the fire got more and more intense. So that's when the little ones said they went to their fire drill, they went outside, and they jumped the roof, and they went up the hill. And I didn't know that they had left. And so when I finally went back to get them, I couldn't find them. And the SWAT officer said, you have to go. And I said, I'm not leaving here without those children. And so we broke down locked doors and closets. They went up into the attic. They went down into the little basement area. We were looking for them for 10 minutes. Finally, there was a call on the radio, and they said, the children are found. They were up at the top of the hill with other neighbors. So once that happened, the SWAT officer said, you have to leave now. And I said, no problem. So I jumped one fence of a neighbor's with my three dogs, and then I ran up the hill and I jumped another fence. By the time this was all done, I was up at La Pietra School, and then I walked down. The whole thing took about an hour and 43 minutes, and that's the longest hour and 43 minutes of my life ever. Let's hope for the best, Kath. Let's hope that going forward, that we can, if you see something, say something about mental illness. We just really have to get a handle on this, because Yarder was a good man at one point, and he went into the abyss of madness. And unfortunately, we could not help him, and we should have been able to. And let's hope going forward that we can figure out something, whether it's government or people in general, can figure out something about helping mental illness.
Let's look forward to that in 2021 and beyond. But thank you.
Yes. You're welcome.
The loss of two police officers, Tiffany Enriquez and Kauliki Kalama, killed in the line of duty, leaves a gaping hole in our community. Police Chief Susan Ballard said that day she thought of them as her kids, as they worked directly under her for many years.
Ballard and the HPD members lined the police headquarters not once, but twice, saying aloha to the two officers in a final pass-in-review ceremony that followed the tragedy. Enrique's left behind three daughters. Officer Kalama had a teenage son. And months after the shooting, Kalama's wife, Ka'o Hiunani, also died after an illness. The police union organized a fund drive to help support the families for their loss that day. Today, people are honoring their memory at the Waikiki Police Substation and at the main headquarters where their names join the officers killed in the line of duty. Some officers were talking about marching from the substation to Hibiscus Drive later this evening to honor Enrique's and Kalama. That wraps it up for today. Tomorrow marks not only the inauguration of our new president, but also the opening of the legislature. With concerns about health and safety, it will be like no other. We'd like your feedback. Were you affected by the Hibiscus tragedy? Did you take part in this weekend's mass vaccinations here on Oahu? Call our talkback line. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.